about fly fishing internet radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Bo Beasley, and we'll be answering your most important questions on fly fishing for shad on the Rappahannock River. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we are broadcasting live over the internet. If you'd like to ask Bo a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box there to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. If you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this show cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Bo Beasley about fly fishing for shad on the Rappahannock River. The Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida, in the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help the recovery of rare native trout, the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and helped with the Striped Bass Game Fish 2006 Symposium in Foxborough, Massachusetts, just to name a few. Federation won a National Conservation Award for its efforts. To continue this great work on behalf of all of us as fly fishers, the Federation needs to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects, and by doing so, give something back to the sport that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to the Federation website at www.fedflyfishers.org. That's fedflyfishers.org. Before we introduce Bo, I'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and also a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have 2 chances to win there in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Bo's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll be announcing those winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a $20 gift certificate, compliments of Front Range Anglers in Boulder, Colorado. Their website is www.frontrangeanglers.com. And here's how you can win that. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question's going to be about something that we talked about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location in the same text box on our homepage where you can ask questions during the show. So listen closely, use your best typing skills there when we ask, and first one to submit it gets that $20 gift certificate, which you can redeem either online at frontrangeanglers.com or in their store directly in Boulder, Colorado. Our guest tonight is Bo Beasley. Bo has fished the waters of Virginia for over 30 years, with his travels taking him from the briny waters of the Chesapeake Bay, seeking stripers, to the cold water trout streams of Shenandoah National Park in search of native brookies. His writing career began in the mid-1990s with a small article in Virginia Outdoor Weekly and has since been published in American Angler, Mid-Atlantic Fly Fishing Guide, Virginia Sportsman, Richmond Magazine, and Fly Tire. He is a contributing editor for Fly Fish America and is currently the Mid-Atlantic Field Editor for Eastern Fly Fishing. Bo is the director of the Virginia Fly Fishing Festival and is a career captain with Fairfax County Fire and Rescue Department, assigned to Engine Company 1. He currently serves as the Vice President of Communications for the Virginia State Council of Trout Unlimited and lives with his wife and children in Warrenton, Virginia. His first book, Fly Fishing Virginia, A No-Nonsense Guide to Top Waters, was released in May of 2007. It's available in bookstores throughout the country. Bo, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Well, thank you so much, Roger. I'm happy to be here and looking forward to spending the evening with you.
Well, we've got a lot of things to cover, Bo. We've got a lot of questions that have come in, and again, we want to thank all our listeners for submitting those questions in advance. And again, a reminder that you can ask questions during the show by going to our homepage there and submitting the questions online. So What we're going to do tonight, folks, is Bo's going to help us learn more about the Rappahannock River specifically and the shad that run up it and the shad that we'd like to fly fish for. So let's start with the fish itself, with shad. There's a lot of people that may not be familiar with it. So could you first describe the fish itself and maybe explain, you know, if any,
sure,
of the different varieties that exist out there?
Sure. There are two primary shad that people fish for, American shad and hickory shad. Shad are herring, but not all herring are shad. The largest member of the herring family is the American shad, and the American is the largest and probably most sought after of the shad between the shad and the American shad and the hickory. American shad are also called white shad, and sometimes people get them confused and think that white shad are different than American shad, but really it's a different name for the exact same species. The other shad, which is pretty prolific in Virginia where I live, is called hickory shad, and they are smaller. Sometimes they're called bluebacks. Sometimes they're called skip herring, because they've been known to skip along the top of the water when they're being chased by saltwater species and sometimes misidentified as menhaden. Hickories are very easy to identify because they have a series of spots behind their gills, and both the American shad and the hickory shad have a very deeply forked tail. And when I teach my classes, I usually have a slide up showing the hickory shad, and you can, if you've never seen one, if you're holding your hand out and you take your thumb and hold it over your last two fingers like you're making the peace sign and turn it sideways, that's what their tails look like. They're very, very forked, and that only means one thing in the fish world. That means speed. These are very fast fish, whether they're Americans or whether they're hickories. They fight aggressively. They readily take flies, and they have a very long history in the United States, and it's a great species to fish for. They fight hard, they have a lot of heart, and they've got a long, long, proud history in the country. As a matter of fact, it predates the country because the shad were obviously here when John Smith landed in near Virginia in 1607 and were written about by the American Indians, even written about by the Rappahannocks, which is what the Rappahannock River is named after, the local tribe that lived there. The Rappahannock is actually in Virginia. It's contained in the whole river is contained in the state, and it's about 186 miles long.
Okay, before we get, I'd like to get to the river a little later on. I want to stick with the fish here for right now.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk a little bit more about that. We did get one question in here, Bo, from Mike in South Africa, and he says they have shad down there in the salt around South Africa, but he's a little bit confused as to whether they are similar or the same as, you know, the American coast shad.
They probably,
do you know anything about that?
Yeah, they probably are. Shad are a anadromous fish, and what that means is they live most of their life in salt water, and they go to fresh water to reproduce. An example of an anadromous fish would be a salmon, which people are familiar with migrating. So people sometimes get confused because they hear about shad in salt water, and then they hear about shad in fresh water, and they think, well, it can't be the same fish, but actually it is. American shad and hickories both migrate all the way from Florida all the way up to Nova Scotia. They usually enter the waters in Virginia. That's what I know the most about. That's what I fish the most. Usually from the last week of March right through the first week of May. So April is prime time. Now, in the southern part of the state, if you're listening now and you're in North Carolina, any day now, they should be coming up into rivers like the Roanoke River, the York River is a little further down in Virginia than is the Rappahannock, and they'll start coming up there in the middle of March, and then as the season comes on, the water temperature hits about 52 degrees, they come out of the ocean where they live most of their lives, and then spend about 4 or 5 weeks migrating up the river, spawning, and then going back out to sea.
That was one of Kevin Bradley's questions from Coatesville, Pennsylvania. How long do they actually stay in the fresh water?
So yeah, well, there's, There's two schools of thought. When you say stay in the water, stay in fresh water, it depends on whether you mean the fry or whether you mean the adult fish. The adult fish are going to stay probably anywhere from 3 weeks to 6 weeks, depending on how far they have to go upstream. And interestingly enough, biologists believe that fish, shad, find their way back to their particular river with their sense of smell, which I think is pretty interesting. They will stay in the river anywhere from a couple of weeks to a month, but the fry will stay, which usually takes anywhere from 4 days to 2 weeks to hatch. The fry will stay as long as 6 months. So unlike some people that think the shad come and they have a few eggs and they leave right away, they're around for a while, but they don't eat much when they're here. They don't eat much until after they spawn and then on their way back down. If you're catching the fish, particularly, and we'll talk about fishing later on, but if you catch a shad on the surface, which is very, very rare, that fish has already spawned and they're on their way back to the ocean. Now,
okay. So they don't eat then on the way up, and the, but they do eat on the way back out.
Correct. They don't, and they don't eat much then either. But they don't eat much hardly at all when they come into fresh water. They have the capacity. Now, I know what somebody's going to send an email question in, and they'll say, well, why in the world are we fishing for them if they don't eat? Why would they, how are we going to catch them? And I'll talk about that later on.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
They spend anywhere, like I said, from a few weeks to a month in the river, and they lay their eggs. And again, all this is determinative on a lot of things like water flow, moon cycles, the ebb and flow of the river, whether it's been very, very rainy and there's a lot of water and they can easily get up the river, or whether they can only go up in stages. Because remember, the rivers they're going up in the Rappahannock, like the Rappahannock, they're all tidal rivers. So at any given time of the day, the river could fluctuate by a couple of feet. So obviously, if there's only 6 inches of water in a particular part of the river at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, by 8 o'clock in the evening, there might be a foot and a half. That's a lot of water for these fish to have traction in to go upstream. The interesting thing about the shad is when people come out later on in July and August and they go, oh, look at all the pretty minnows in the water. What a lot of people don't know is those are shad fry. And they're very, very important to the fishery because the smallmouth bass eat them and the largemouth bass, at least in the Rappahannock, eat them, and even bluegill. So the fry are very important to the fishery as a whole because of all the other species that eat the fry.
Okay, that brings up another question related. Carl Anderson, Brooklyn, New York, says, as a food source, are the eggs of shad as important to the Eastern River ecosystem as the salmon eggs are of the Northwest ecosystem?
Not so much. A shad egg is about the size of a BB. They're really, really small.
Okay.
Some of them aren't even that size, so they're kind of difficult to see. And the average, this would be a little interesting factoid for you, the average female, adult female shad will lay a quarter of a million eggs. That's a lot of eggs for one fish. And they are broadcast spawners. Now, what that means is they don't dig a red, or they don't have a particular lie where they stay. They go into an area, they broadcast their eggs, the female will cast her eggs out, and then as many as three or four males will come behind her and put out their milk and fertilize the eggs. So the eggs are not consumed so much by the other fish, although I'm sure that happens at times, but the fry, once they hatch, are a pretty important food source. But it's
okay.
not so much when you think of salmon and
right.
As large as their eggs are.
Right, right. Well, David Shotsko in New York City wants to know how far north on the east coast of the United States is the shad's range.
Well, you know, New York is blessed with some very good shad fishing, actually, in the Hudson River. Any coastal river that's rather large is probably going to have a shad run. But to answer his question, the shad run way past New York, all the way up past Maine, up to Nova Scotia. Their range goes anywhere from Florida all the way up to Nova Scotia. Now, obviously, these same fish don't go, you know, they're going to a specific river as a general
right.
rule. Now, sometimes they'll be off a little bit, which is actually why biologists like to plant them in some places, because if, for example, it's a great way to continue the species, because, for example, let's say that the fish were honing in on the Rappahannock. Well, some of them will stop at the York, which is south of the Rappahannock. Some of them will go all the way up to the Potomac, which is above the Rappahannock. So if something were to happen to the Rappahannock River, that strain of fish will already be in those other two rivers. So that's one of the main reasons they put them on the West Coast, because they knew once they got a foothold in one area, they would migrate their way up. So they do try to pretty much come back to the same river, but shad, you know, sometimes they're like drivers on the interstate, and they'll pull off at an exit they weren't necessarily planning on going to and just make the best of it.
Well, that brings up another question that I have is, are they then similar to the Atlantic salmon? Now, I know the Atlantic salmon, they vary as to what years they come in. In other words, the same fish don't come in every year, and that is part of the survival mechanism, too. Do shad do similar things?
You know, it's very, very interesting that you mention that, because one of the interesting things about shad is that their life cycle is anywhere from 3 to 6 years, and a lot of it determines where they are as far as their survivability. Shad that migrate from, say, the Roanoke River south down to Florida will probably migrate once, maybe twice in their entire lifetime, and then die. The mortality rate of fish in the mid-Atlantic, which is generally thought of from the North Carolina line up to New York, can spawn multiple times, and they have about a 50% mortality rate. The fish that spawn from New York above the Hudson River up to the Bay of Fundy in Canada, they might spawn and migrate 5 or 6 times. So it's really odd that the fish towards the northern end of the East Coast have a much higher survival rate. As you go down the coast, the spawning ability of the fish is cut several percentage points. So when you get down to some place like Florida, that fish that spawns there might be 4 years old and spawn one time and die. And the exact same fish has about a 50% mortality rate once it gets to the mid-Atlantic. So it's conceivable that you could catch the same fish twice or even 3 times in a single lifetime of that fish if you were at the right place at the right time in the right river 3 years in a row. But the fish, that's why the fishing grounds are so good, and we practically went to war at times with other countries over the shad and other fish species up in Canada, because the survivability of the fish is so much greater, their numbers are so much greater. So to answer your question, yep, they could migrate once and then die in Florida. They could migrate 2 or 3 times in the mid-Atlantic. And if they're above New York and the New England area all the way up to the Bay of Fundy in Canada, you know, they could spawn 5 times before they make their last run.
Okay. Well, we have to take a little break here, but when we come back, we'll be talking more about tactics, fly fishing tactics for shad. The Platte River Fly Shop in Casper, Wyoming features a first-class website covering all aspects of fly fishing, the tailwaters of the North Platte River, including up-to-date local fishing reports, fly patterns, guide services, and online shopping for top-of-the-line gear for any travel destination. The Platte River Fly Shop provides a professional guide staff for the Blue Ribbon Trophy, Gray Reef, and Miracle Mile sections of the North Platte River. Visit their extensive website at www.wyotrout.com. That's wyotrout.com. Or call the Platte River Fly Shop at 1-307-237-5997. Again, that's 1-307-237-5997. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Bo Beasley about fly fishing for shad on the Rappahannock River. If you'd like to ask Bo a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, Bo, let's see. We've got Kevin Bradley, Coatesville, Pennsylvania, just north of you there a bit. Says the range of shad was once massive. John McPhee in his book, The Founding Fish, indicates that shad runs were vast and plentiful in almost all major eastern rivers and streams. Has much of that range been reduced?
Yes, it has, and there's no big surprise here. The biggest impediment to shad, quite frankly, are dams. To give you an idea in what kind of effect overfishing and dams have had, in the 1800s, around the Chesapeake Bay region, it is estimated that the average yearly take in shad was about 17 million pounds. Now, by 1970, that number had plummeted to 2 million. So you think about that. That's a huge reduction, primarily because of dams, because the shad couldn't get up to their migratory ponds. The other thing to keep in mind is pollution. Although the fish aren't really in the river long enough to take pollution into damage them as adult fish, it does affect their spawning grounds. So let me give you an example. We talked about the Hudson River earlier today, earlier this evening, and there are PCBs in that river. Well, biologists really aren't concerned that the PCBs could somehow affect the shad in the few weeks that they're in the river, because they're just not there long enough to absorb it. But the river itself could be damaged, so the offspring that try to grow in the river afterwards have a much higher mortality rate. So pollution has had a big effect, dams have had a big effect, and then, of course, overfishing has also had a huge impact, particularly with gill nets and that sort of thing, which don't allow smaller fish, have a lot of bycatch. So
right.
That doesn't mean that all gill netters are bad. I'm just saying, purse seines and stuff like that don't allow for a whole lot of escape or seepage, tend to gather a lot of the fish, and overfishing and dams and pollution are the three biggest factors. But they are making a resurgence, though.
Are the shad commercially fished?
Yes, in some places they are. As a matter of fact, commercially fishing for shad, you personally, Roger, know one of the biggest commercial shad fishermen in America. And that was George Washington. George Washington was one of the largest commercial shad fishermen. As a matter of fact, within 6 months of the Revolutionary War, George Washington was actually selling shad, salted shad, in barrels to Great Britain. So he actually, if you go to his home place in Mount Vernon in Virginia, it's not by accident that he built his house on the Potomac River. The Potomac has a huge shad run, and he has all kinds of records that he kept of how he would go out with nets, and his slaves would go out with nets and bring in tons and tons of shad. George Washington commercially fished shad for years. Now, the only shad in Virginia that you can keep are hickory shad. American shad have to be released. They're endangered in Virginia. Now, not every state is like that. Some states allow you to keep American shad, and others don't. But in Virginia, every American shad has to be released. And the hickory shad, however, can be kept. And actually, the Latin name for shad actually means savory fish. So they are
good to eat.
Yes, they are good to eat. There are a lot of bones in them, but they are good to eat.
Now, you had mentioned earlier the west coast of the United States, that shad were planted there at one time.
Mm-hmm.
How is that as a shad fishery? Is it a thriving fishery? Is it a
Yeah, it is pretty good. I have only had the opportunity to fish for shad once on the West Coast, but I had a very good day. I was out fishing with my father-in-law, John Johnson, who's a retired forest ranger, and I love telling the story. We were out on the Columbia, and he had never shad fished before, and I was able to look at the river, and I was watching these four or five spin fishermen standing there, and they really weren't doing much, and there were some guys that were bait fishing, and they weren't doing anything, and I told my father-in-law, I said, we need to be out on that point. I said, there's somebody standing there now, but if that guy leaves, that's where we're going to go. And about 5 minutes later, the guy packed up because he hadn't caught anything. And then my father-in-law and I commenced to catch one shad after another about every 3 or 4 minutes, the 2 hours that we stood there. And rather than getting, and we're surrounded by spin fishermen, and rather than getting angry, the spin fishermen just thought it was great. They just couldn't believe that you could catch shad on a fly rod. The places that you can fish out west, if you're a west coaster, in California, the Sacramento would probably be the best known place to fish for shad. You can also, of course, fish the Yuba, which is a place to go. The American River is also an opportunity, and the Trinity River. Now, for Oregon, the Bonneville Dam causes some problems for the in the Columbia, but they've actually got a fish passage there, and you can go in and watch them swim upstream with the salmon and all that kind of good stuff. But in Oregon, the Willamette River is a good place to go. The Smith and the Sandy are also opportunities for you.
So and those are all spring runs as well there on the West
Coast?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, interestingly enough, out in the West Coast, the runs out there are about 6 weeks behind the runs here, so our shad fishery finishes pretty much peters out altogether by the first week of May, and theirs begins at the middle of May and runs all the way through June. So if you get tired of trout fishing and you want to shad fish for a little while out west, call one of your local fly shops out there, and they won't think you're crazy. I mean, people do fish for stuff other than shad out west. You know, I went out, and my first time on the Columbia just had a great day. With the Columbia, it's an issue because it's such a big river. But if you can find a place to wade down, you will have a successful day there.
Okay, now we also had a question from Carl Anderson, Brooklyn, New York. We want to know if dropping water levels of the Great Lakes are affecting shad. So are shad up in the Great Lakes as well then?
You know what? I truly don't know. I've never heard of anybody fishing for shad in the Great Lakes, but if he's asking the question, the only thing I could think of, is it possible? Sure, it's possible because the St. Lawrence feeds them, and the St. Lawrence obviously opens up into the ocean. I can't speak to that because I really haven't fished there, but it does stand to reason that if they have serious water problems, it's not any different than any other migratory fish. They have to have the water to go upstream.
Right, right. Okay, let's move on, Bo. Talk about the Rappahannock itself.
Okay.
Can you kind of give us a tour from the mouth upstream and how it changes character as you go upstream?
Sure. The Rappahannock is just a fantastic river. It's about 180 miles long, and it's kind of, if you're looking at a clock, the mouth of the river would be at about 4 o'clock. That's the best way to describe it. And it would empty directly into the Chesapeake Bay. And I actually have a picture on the back of my book with a gentleman holding a 28-inch striper, who, by the way, is a strong FFF member, Dick Romagliano, good friend of mine. He caught this striper right at the mouth of the Rappahannock. It is not uncommon at all to have shad and striper runs happen at the exact same time. But the mouth of the river empties into the Chesapeake Bay, and you go up and go up and go up, and then eventually the river becomes more narrow and it becomes less deep. And then as you get into the Fredericksburg area, it can go as shallow as a couple of feet. You have the falls there, which is right near the Route 1 bridge where a lot of people go to wade. And then as you go further up the river to what I call the Upper Rappahannock, which is near Remington, you can actually get Class 3 water up there. So it gets much more narrow, and it gets much faster. So, but the fish do go that far up. As a matter of fact, the Rappahannock part of the Rapidan actually splits off and empties into the Rappahannock right near Fredericksburg. So it certainly has a lot of different characteristics. The Rappahannock has a very active shad and striper fishery, but it also is very good for smallmouth bass, and then is in the upper portion, and then as you get down further to the mouth of the river gets much slower, and that's where you start picking up largemouth bass and even catfish for that matter.
Okay. Now, I notice there's a lot of, I'm looking at your book right now, at the couple of maps you have in there. I notice there's a lot of tributaries coming into the Rappahannock. Are those significant as fisheries at all, or?
Well, the biggest tributary is the Rapidan River. That's the biggest tributary to the Rappahannock. And, of course, there are all kinds of creeks and streams that flow in, some of which don't even have any names or their own private property. So there are a lot of tributaries. You know, the Rappahannock actually drains about 6% of the entire state. And it is a very important river from a landmark standpoint. It was kind of a watery Mason-Dixon line, if you will, during the Civil War. And both the Union and the Confederate armies used it as a way to keep the other at bay. The whole town of Fredericksburg changed hands quite a few times during the Civil War. So the Rappahannock has got a lot of history. Interestingly enough, we'll digress just a little bit more talking about the Rappahannock. George Washington's childhood story of cutting down the cherry tree supposedly happened on the Rappahannock. He grew up on the banks of the Rappahannock on his sister's farm called Ferry, F-E-R-R-Y, Ferry Farm. So your readers and listeners might want to Google that on the Internet one time and take a look at that. I tell people in my book that it makes me think that maybe George was cutting down the cherry tree to go shad fishing, because in Virginia, the sure sign for you to go shad fishing is if the cherry trees are blooming. If the cherry trees are in bloom, the shad are in the river. It's just kind of a natural timing between the trees and the fish. And I've never known that not to be the case. I have never seen a time when the cherry trees were blooming that the shad were not in the river.
Okay, good. Good tip. Now, Tad in Oaksville, Virginia, wants to know how far the shad run up. I think you just said,
well, they went up quite a ways. I mean, they took the Embry Dam came down in 2003. It was blown up by the Army Corps of Engineers, and that dam had been there for 153 years.
And where was that at?
The Embry Dam. It was in Fredericksburg.
Oh, in Fredericksburg, okay.
Mm-hmm. And I was actually there. It was put in as a hydroelectric dam. I was there the day they blew it up, and it was quite impressive. I don't have an exact location as to where the last shad goes, for lack of a better choice of words.
Yeah.
But I do know that the game department biologist I spoke with said that both shad and stripers were seen by some of their people 50 miles above the dam the first year it was blown up, which is unbelievable. But a very positive sign, because it added about 100 miles of spawning ground for the fish.
So you're basically, are you telling me from the mouth to Remington is all good fishable water for shad?
Yes.
Just depending on the
sure
timing?
Is. Yeah.
Okay.
The only thing is, once you get south of Fredericksburg, the river gets a lot deeper, and sometimes, you know, you would have to employ a boat. But the shad fishing, as far as wading goes, is very easily done right, you know, in downtown Fredericksburg, believe it or not. I do have two pieces of advice for you, though. One is, if you're going to fish on the Rappahannock, you absolutely, absolutely have to have felt-soled shoes or some type of material wading shoe that gives you really good traction. It is a very dangerous river. As a matter of fact, they usually lose anywhere from 2 to 5 anglers every single year that get swept away and drown on the Rappahannock. So,
wow.
And most of those occur because people are not careful with their footing. There's a great deal of current in the river. And the river is Algonquian Indian, and it actually means rapidly rising water. So, you know, when you think it's very much a tidal basin or tidal river there in Fredericksburg, and I have personal firsthand experience of having waded out to a part in a river using rocks to cross and just have a grand old time catching fish for a couple of hours and then look over my shoulder to make my way back and realize that the rocks I came across on are now underwater.
Okay.
So that makes it difficult to get back when you don't know where you're stepping.
How far up does that tidal surge affect you?
Quite a ways, even above the falls to some extent. Not as much above the falls, obviously, but
okay.
It can vary as much as a couple of feet.
Okay.
So usually if you're above the bridge, I'd say, you know, if you're 150 yards, 200 yards above the main bridge there, you're pretty safe. The water changes constantly. The direction of the river changes constantly, and what might be a little island there one year, the next year it might not be there. It's constantly in a state of change. So
right.
It's not like it's got a really hard rock bottom all the time. The
right.
river's constantly shifting there.
Now, we did have a question from Ed Nicholson in Port Tobacco, Maryland. You had mentioned the dam removal, and he asked what effect has that on the shad fishing. You did say that the fish went past it now.
Yeah, it's been very positive.
Okay.
It's been very positive. Now, first there was some controversy in the beginning because when the shad, when the dam was blown, there was, you know, over 150 years of sediment that got washed downstream. So some guys were pretty angry that their good shad holes were filled in with silt. But just like anything else, after a couple of good storms, a lot of the silt was blown down. The river probably shifted back and forth pretty heavily for a couple of years. But now it seems to have settled down somewhat. But to answer the question, it's been a very positive thing for the shad and the stripers, I might add.
Yeah. It's funny how, you know, given if you give nature just a little chance, how quickly she can come back and fix things back to the way they should be.
Right.
You know, give it a little time and she'll come back and help us out again. You'd mentioned both, and we have a question from Jim Mossor in West Virginia. He asks about timing again. You did say spring. Did the white shad and hickory shad both run at the same time?
Yeah, the hickories will come in anywhere from a week to 10 days earlier for some reason. We're not exactly sure why, but the hickories usually precede the Americans by a week or so. But I tell people that the best time to go is the last week of March through the first week of May. So any time in your calendar that says April, head to the river.
Okay. Now, what's the difference in size between the white shad and the hickory?
That's a good question. A lot of times they look a lot alike, but there are generally two ways you can very quickly tell, do I have American shad, do I have a hickory shad? One is the difference between lunch. The other one is a free pair of silver bracelets that the Virginia Department of Game and Inland Fisheries will let you wear behind your back. So you need to be very careful of which shad you're taking home. American shad grow much larger than hickory, anywhere from 1 to 3 pounds, 3 being the upper size limit. The American shad grow from anywhere from 2 up to 7, 8. The biggest one I've ever heard of is 9 pounds. So the American shad can almost triple the size of a hickory. The problem is they really do look a lot alike. Even seasoned veterans sometimes have to take a second look. The easiest way to determine, okay, do I have an American or do I have a hickory? Very simple test. Look at their mouth. A hickory shad's bottom lip comes up to its nose. Kind of looks like a tarpon. As a matter of fact, shad are often called poor man's tarpon. But if it's kind of like a bulldog, the bottom lip of that hickory shad will come up to where you think its nose would be. An American shad, and the way I remember this is, I have a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old, so I'm constantly trying to come up with creative ways to teach them the alphabet and counting. And alligator starts with the letter A. And the mouth of an American shad is a lot like an alligator, meaning it meets in the middle. The hickory shad's mouth swoops up from the bottom and meets the top of its nose. But an American shad's mouth is very linear, it's straight, and is more like an alligator. So that's the best, fastest way to determine. You know, if you have a 5-pound shad, guaranteed it's an American. You know, the pickers don't get that big. But if it's a smaller fish, then you can look at their mouth and make that determination.
Right, right. And just to kind of close up talking about rivers out there, if you weren't going to fish the Rappahannock for shad, what other rivers would you choose as prime places to fish for shad?
So there's a bunch in Virginia. Well, let's start at the top and work our way down. Maryland is a great state, but the best thing about Maryland is they let people from Virginia fish in the Potomac. It isn't a Maryland river. I get asked that question all the time. How come the Potomac isn't in your book? Well, it's a Maryland river. It's not a Virginia river. But the Potomac River has a huge shad run. As a matter of fact, the game department often catches shad out of the Potomac and transports it to other places. Another good river to shad fish in would be the York, which is below the Potomac. You can also fish the Pamunkey, the Mattapani, the Nottoway. These are all in Virginia. In North Carolina, you can fish the Roanoke River. is a great place to fish. There in Weldon, I've fished there before, and there's great shad fishing there, and there's also very good striper fishing. Also in North Carolina, you've got the Cape Fear and the Tar River. So there's a lot of different places, but you can catch shad all the way down to Florida if you want. It's not hard. I'd call your local fly shop, and usually the more coastal stores are the ones that aren't as far inland, usually are a little more adroit at knowing which fisheries best hold shad. But all those rivers in Virginia that I mentioned hold good population of shad. Even the Ravana, which I didn't find out until I started researching my book. I knew about the Ravana River, but I didn't know that they had a shad population. And it's because it's just been transplanted lately. It had it originally. They had a band there. Lo and behold, shad fishery went away. And they are now transplanting shad in the Ravana, and they suspect in the next 5 to 10 years that the shad fishery in Ravana will bounce back.
Okay. You said you kind of faded out there when you said the Ravana had a what?
Ravana had a good shad fishery years ago, but they had a dam placed there.
Oh,
and
a
the
dam? Okay.
Yeah, the Olin, the mills down, the Woolen Mills Dam in Ravana near Fredericksburg. And really put a hurting on the shad population. But they're now transplanting shad there, and they expect it to be a very thriving fishery in the next 5 to 10 years.
Okay. Well, we need to take a little break again. But when we come back, we'll be answering more of your questions and learn a few of Bo's secrets about fly fishing for shad. Women's fly fishing in Alaska is owned and operated by well-known female guide Pudge Kleinkopf. Women's Fly Fishing offers several lodge-based fly fishing schools for women, as well as an array of small group guided trips for women and couples to some of Alaska's best-known waters for salmon, rainbow trout, arctic grayling, and char. Pudge also leads saltwater fly fishing groups to Mexico each spring. Beginners are welcome, and equipment is provided. Learn more about fly fishing for women at www.womensflyfishing.net or email them at Pudge, that's P-U-D-G-E at women's, with an E, womensflyfishing.net. Phone number is 907-274-7113, 907-274-7113. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Bo Beasley about fly fishing for shad on the Rappahannock River. If you'd like to ask Bo a question, just go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com, and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. And we'll receive your question immediately. We'll try to answer as many of them as we can on the show tonight. Okay, Bo, let's talk a little bit about equipment. Jared Sartini in Holland, Michigan, wants to know, what's the basic setup, rod, reel, line, leader, and so forth for fishing for shad?
Well, Jared, I got some good news for you. If you do any fishing for smallmouth bass or even stripers, you might already have what you need, or you can easily convert to what you need. Shad typically like water with a fair amount of current, and they really fight very, very well for their size. So the other thing is shad don't give up. They're kind of like Marines. They just keep going and keep going and keep going. There's no such thing as playing a shad out until he quits fighting. He will fight until there's no water left, and then he will flop around on the bank. So you need to, I tell people you need to get the fish in quickly and release them just as quickly. Now, the best thing for you to use, or I recommend people to use, is 7 to 9 weights. Now, I know that's an odd kind of range there, and I've actually even used 5 weights in the Rappahannock, but it's all determined on one thing, the depth of the water and the current of the water, because shad only have 2 things to keep them safe, and these 2 things are what you're going to have to remember when you're fishing for them. Shad can only protect themselves by being low in the water column to get away from, particularly from birds, and also from other creatures that would reach out and snatch them, and sometimes we don't think about that. But if they're, you know, if they're huddled in a pool, it is not uncommon or unreasonable to think that a possum or a raccoon would even snatch them. But it's very, you know, common to see birds on the Rappahannock diving for shad. As a matter of fact, I've caught a few fish with scar marks on their back where they have gotten away from a heron or gotten away from some kind of seagull and continued upstream. So as far as rods go, you're going to need, I would recommend a 7 to a 9 weight. Now, you're going to say, well, Bo, what if there's not as much current, and what if we're in fairly shallow water? Well, that's just like anything else, and you're going to scale back, but I really wouldn't use anything less, ever use anything less than a 5. And even then, I'd be kind of leery. Now, if you're going to use a lighter rod, like a 5 or 6 weight, you can use a weight forward floating line, but you're going to have to cast a little further upstream, and you're going to have to use a sink tip. Shad are not going to be up near the top. They only have speed and the depth of the water to protect them. So the fish are at the bottom of the water column, and that's where your fly needs to be. So I recommend 200 to 300 grain sinking lines, and if I may be so bold, Airflow makes an excellent sinking line. And their depth finder is a very, very good product. And they're also
sinking line, not sinking tip line, right?
Right, sinking line. Like, okay. Let's say, for example, you're fishing a large river like the Rappahannock, and you want to sweep across an area that's 40 or 50 yards long. You cast out diagonally or at a 90-degree angle, and you keep your line tight. This is not something where you just kind of hurdy-gurdy let your line go down, because it's going to get wrapped around something and it's going to get caught up on the bottom when you're using sinking line. But here's the deal, Roger. If you're not getting hung up on the bottom, you're not shad fishing. That's where the shad are, and that's where your fly needs to be. So 200 to 300 grain lines if you're using a bigger rod and larger water. But let's say we were fishing the Rappahannock, but we were fishing it much higher up. We're fishing it above Remington. Well, there you may not need a sinking line because the water is only a couple feet deep and the current may not be as heavy. But if you're in heavy current, then you're definitely going to need that sinking line. Or if you're on a boat, probably the biggest boat fishery for shad is the James River. As a matter of fact, I've read colonial records that said the shad migration was so large in the spring during the early 1800s that they actually had to move the cattle and the horses away from the river because the shad migration was so strong it would scare the cattle to the point they'd knock the fences down to get away from them. So, but in rivers like the James and even places like the Roanoke, you would need a sinking line to get down, you know, if it's 7, 8, 9 feet depth worth of water, particularly if there's any kind of current. So
basically what you're saying is, one way to approach it is, if you don't have a heavier rig, move up river and get
right
into some shallower water.
Try to get into some shallower water. Right.
But I also kind of am hearing you say that you'd like to see people use a little heavier rod because they're really fighting a saltwater fish here.
They are. They are fighting saltwater fish. They are.
And the other
thing is, Lord help you, if you are casting small clousers and on your 5-weight rod, you get hit by an 8-pound striper. So that's another thing to keep in mind. Stripers migrate the same time as the shad. So if you have a five-weight, and there's eyes that do it, you can tell because their reels are just screaming. And you see the line take off, and then you see the line change color, and then you see backing, and then you hear dink, and that's it. dink, and then you're done. So I would say, you know, if you're not sure, I would tend to go with a little heavier rod. The other thing to keep in mind is, Roger, if you got your line wrapped around something or you get it snagged on something, then with that heavier rod, you can generally put a little more pressure on than maybe you would feel comfortable doing otherwise. So I would say, you know, use that 7 and 9 weight rod because it is a saltwater fish. They do primarily live their life in saltwater. Believe me, once you get hold of one, you will be glad that you had the bigger rod. And here's another little tip for you. It is very common for these fish to jump out of the water or to even do a little miniature tail walk. Chances are, if your fish jumps out of the water, it's a male. Now, people look at me and go, how can you say that? How can you look at a fish and tell whether it's a male or a female? Well, it's real simple. It's, as Sherlock Holmes would say, it's elementary. The female shad are much larger than the males, sometimes twice the size of the males, and they flat out just have a hard time getting up in the air. They don't like breaking the surface and coming up, as opposed to the males, which aren't carrying a third of their body weight in eggs. So if chances are if your fish is airborne, it's a buck.
Okay. Good tip. Well, you answered Chris Morris's question, which was, do you change gear and fish for stripers as well? I guess you just better be prepared to catch a striper as well as a shad.
Absolutely. That way, I mean, if you have an 8-weight rod, that's what you normally take. 8 and 9 weights is what you normally take for stripers anyhow. If you have a 7-weight, you may have to just be a little more patient.
Now, what about leader, tippet? What's your rig there?
You know, these fish are not leader shy. I wouldn't use anything less than 2X. And I'd say, you know, 2X, 3 feet max. You know, there's no need to break it down, you know, 3X to 2X to 1X. Just straight to 3X or even, you know, even 2X about, 3 to 4 feet max. You don't want it to be real long. The simple fact is, because if you're throwing a 300-grain line, and then you have three, or let's say you get crazy and you put 5 feet a leader, what do you think is going to happen to your fly? It's going to float up, or the water current could push it up. Whereas if the tippet or leader is shorter, then that's, you know, it's just that much closer to that sinking tip.
Okay. Kevin Brady in Coatesville, Pennsylvania, again, asks about spay rods. Anybody using spay rods to angle for shad?
You know, not that I'm aware of, but there's no reason that you couldn't. I mean, there's absolutely no reason why you couldn't use a spay rod to shad fish other than, you know, you are going to look kind of strange if you're landing, you know, a 1 to 1.5 pound hickory. Of course, you could always tell people that you were striper fishing and happened to catch the shad by accident.
Okay. Yeah, he was asking basically because somebody, you know, spay rods are used in a lot of big rivers, a lot of wide rivers. So.
Sure, there's no reason that you couldn't.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about food and flies here. You already had talked a little bit about this, but Jim Mosser in West Virginia asks, do shad feed once they enter fresh water? You started to talk about this. Why don't you go a little bit further with that?
Yeah. Shad typically don't eat when they're spawning, when they're going upstream. Mr. Shad only has one thing on his mind when he's going upstream, and that is finding Mrs. Shad. That's it. That's all he's interested in doing. What I often get asked is, you know, how am I going to catch them if they're not going to open their mouth to eat? Well, they're not eating as much as they are biting at something that's agitating them. So shad flies all have three things in common. So there's little notes to keep. Shad flies have three things in common. They are bright, which means they're easy to see. Now, that doesn't mean that they can't come in dark colors like purple or blue or green, but typically they are bright. They are small, which means I define small as size 6 hook or smaller. and they are subsurface. Traditional shad flies will fall into those, will have those three common characteristics, and there are no exceptions. There are no exceptions to that rule. As a general standard rule for shad fishing, they have to be small, bright, and subsurface. Now, shad do eat when they're in the river. They just don't eat much, and typically they eat on the way out. They really don't eat on the way up. They really don't have any desire to do that, and the reason that they so readily hit flies is because, quite frankly, you think about how a gnat is buzzing around your face and you kind of swat at it. It's the same thing. They get aggravated, and you're making them late for a date, and they don't like that, and they hit it, and they hit it pretty hard.
No messing around, huh?
That's right. You're making a guy late for a date.
Well, we've got lots of questions about flies.
Mm-hmm.
John French, we've got Bob Todd in Ohio, Rod Brashears in Amarillo, that just came in online, and also Jim Mosser in West Virginia, all asking about, you know, favorite flies and what colors and sizes.
Sure. Okay, well, let me throw it on you. You don't necessarily have to go out and buy a shad fly. Let me give you an example. You could use a really brightly colored woolly booger. You could use Crazy Charlie, which is a saltwater pattern for bonefish.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But they need to. You could use a pink puff, for example, if you wanted to. You could use a small clouser. But here's what you need to do. You need to ask yourself, is this a small fly? And, again, I define that as size 6 or smaller. Is it bright? And is it a subsurface pattern? That's what you need. So, but are there specific flies? Sure. There are two that I really like a lot because they have wide application. The first one is called a Tommy's Torpedo. Now, this fly was invented by a guy named Tommy Mattioli, who is a saltwater guide out of Hampton, Virginia. And although Tommy's a saltwater guide and spends most of his time chasing stripers out of Hampton, he designed this fly for shad. And it's a great pattern. And if you just Google Tommy's Torpedo, it'd probably come up on the Internet somewhere. His website, if I'm allowed to give that, I don't know about
sure,
it.
Sure, yeah.
I guess.
No, feel
it's
free.
MattyJ, MattyJ, MattyJ.com. Or you could call him, which is 804-314-2672. So that's Tommy's Torpedo. It's bright. It's got a tinsel tail, and it comes in about three or four different colors. The next fly that I really like was invented by a guy named Dave Munson, and it's called the Bugget, B-U-G-G-I-T. Now, the Bugget looks like a little jig, and you're going to look at that and go, I don't even think this is a fly. Well, it's kind of it's a jig. I know fly fishermen use it quite a bit, and they are created commercially by Brookside Flies. Anybody that carries Buggets, and if you just go online and see what these flies look like, it'll give you an indication. Another fly that I really like is Simmons, S-I-M-M-O-N-S, Simmons Shad Fly, made by Umpqua. Is a really good pattern. It's got a bright iridescent body to it. But, you know, they don't have to be fancy. You can easily tie your own shad flies, very easily. Dumbbell eyes, small hook, bright material, and you can do it. Once you look at these shad flies, you'll go, oh, well, that's not so hard.
What small hook? What size hooks should they be using?
I would say I wouldn't use anything larger than, I think the largest size I would use is a size 4. Now, somebody out there is going to say, well, I've caught them on size 2. Well, that's true, but the problem is when you get larger hooks, shad have very small mouths. The larger the hook, you run into two problems, Roger. Number one, they can't get their mouth around it, which is the most common cause of people not being able to hook up on a fish. They'll go, man, it's tapping. They're hitting the fly, but I'm just not catching them. Something's wrong. It's because your hook's too big. You need to drop down a size or two. The other common problem with larger flies is you're going to foul hook the shad. Shad are like FBI agents. They don't go anywhere by themselves. They always go in groups. So, you know, they're going to be in a big school. You're not going to catch them onesies, twosies. As a general rule, you're either going to catch them or you're not. And when they're all schooled up together, swimming back and forth, swatting at it, if you have a fly larger than a size 4, that hook is going to get embedded in the side of one of those fish. So I just tell people to play it safe, and, you know, size 6 to size 12 is probably the optimum sizes. But again, think deep, you know, subsurface pattern, bright, and flashy, because you want them to be able to see it.
Well, when you say flashy, Rod in Amarillo just brought a question in online. Wants to know if you use fluorescent colors, and if so,
yeah,
what colors?
Yes, chartreuse is great. I like white. I tell you what else is really good is a hot orange. I've had very good result on hot orange. Bright yellows are very good. Chartreuse is, you know the old adage, if it ain't chartreuse, it ain't no use. But I have found that dark colors will also work. Black, purple, olive. But one of the things about one of the flies that I mentioned, the bugget, it has a very undulating tail, which moves a lot, and I think that movement, that undulation of the marabou, is probably what sets these fish off.
Okay, now, Ed Hewden in, looks like, Byfield, Massachusetts, he wants to know about, and this is another, there's another person that asks a similar question, is when you say bright, what do you mean by bright? Lots of flash? Tinsel.
Yeah, lots of flash, flashaboo. You could even put, you know, some of the Alaska-type patterns that you see,
right,
you know, with flashaboo and that kind of stuff. They will hit that.
Okay,
and
we
don't. The good thing about shad flies is they don't have to be really pretty. You can come close, and the fish are going to respond.
Yeah, it's really an attractor.
Correct.
More than anything else, yeah.
Correct.
You're not really
mimicking something in the wild. You're more getting their attention by agitating them.
Okay. So Carmen and Marilyn also asked bright pink. It sounds like it could be any one of those bright fluorescent colors.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. Bob Todd in Frazeesburg, Ohio, did the hickory shad take the same flies as the American shad?
Yes, they absolutely will. In a way of shameless self-promotion, in my book, I've got 5 pages of color patterns of different flies that can be used in Virginia, and the ones that I just mentioned are listed there, the Bugget, the Tommy's Torpedo, and some other patterns similar to that. So,
why don't you just take a minute and tell people about your book there?
Okay.
What it is and what it can help them with, because we are talking about Virginia.
right. My book is called Fly Fishing Virginia, A No-Nonsense Guide to Top Waters, and it was published by the No-Nonsense Guide series publishers out of Arizona. It covers 39 different locations in Virginia. So it covers freshwater, trout, bass, smallmouth, largemouth, even warm water impoundments. It also covers saltwater species, meaning striper. So it has 39 locations, all of which come with color detailed maps, and I show you access points and give you some history about the area, tell you where to park, tell you whatever the limits are for the fish, gear recommendations, fly recommendations, and some history about the area. We were talking about the Rappahannock tonight. The upper end of the Rappahannock near Remington is near Kelly's Ford, which was ground that the largest cavalry charge in United States history has ever occurred. So there's all kinds of interesting little factoids in my book about Virginia history, about the patterns that were created specifically in Virginia, like the Tommy's Torpedo, like Hickey's Condor, which is a great bass fly. Another terrific bass pattern is Walt's Poppers. And Walt has been making popping bugs and living in Virginia, and he's been making popping bugs for almost 50 years. So if you ever wanted information on the Shenandoah River or the James River or the New River to smallmouth fish on, or wanted information on shad fishing, like in the Rappahannock, or trout fishing on the famous Jackson River or Back Creek in Virginia or Mossy Creek, I've got all those covered. And you can go to my website, which is www.beaubeasley.com. Look at it, take a look, and if you decide to order it, of course, I'd be happy to autograph it and drop it in the mail to you. Or you can go by your local fly shop or maybe a Barnes & Noble's or a Borders, or you can order it, you know, online. So,
and the title is Fly Fishing Virginia by Bo Beasley. So a no-nonsense guide to top waters.
Right.
Good. Okay, Bo. Well, I'm sure that'll help a lot of the people there that are fishing Virginia. Let's talk a little bit more about, well, a couple, let me catch up with a couple of these that came in. Carmen,
sure.
Again, in Frederick, Maryland. How is the shad run in the Rappahannock compared to the Potomac?
The Potomac has probably got a larger shad run, but remember, it's a much larger river. So the Potomac is a great place to shad fish. You can go out to Fletcher's Boathouse and paddle out and get yourself a little boat and go out there and catch shad till you fall down. If you go further upstream and keep walking and walking by Chain Bridge, you can find access from the road and cast your line out there. Again, I would warn you to make sure that you carry yourself with an eye towards safety out there and make sure you have felt-soled wading shoes on, because once you fall into the Potomac, you're probably going to float right past George Washington's house in Mount Vernon. It's a very fast river, so please be careful while you're out there. But both of those rivers, the Potomac and the Rappahannock, have a good, strong population that's very reliable in the way of when they show up.
Okay. Bart Lombardo in New Jersey says that he's going to be, plans on fishing for the first time the Delaware River up in New Jersey, I guess, for shad.
Yeah, it's a great fishery.
Okay. He was asking about fly patterns. All the ones you just mentioned here should work up
there, I would take it. Yeah, one of the good things about shad patterns is they're pretty ubiquitous. If you find one that works, chances are it's going to work in the Columbia, or it's going to work, you know, in the Delaware, or it's going to work in the James. So once you find a couple, and you usually don't need more than two or three, they'll really key in on them.
Okay. Question from Bill in Page, Arizona. He's asking about a gizzard shad. You haven't mentioned that.
Gizzard shad are not really sought after too much. They have very, very small mouths. They're exceedingly difficult to catch. And they're more used, actually, by bait fishermen. People use casting nets and take gizzard shad and use them as bait primarily for other species. So they're not the same kind of shad that we're talking about that can really be captured by a fly angler.
Okay.
But they are an important bait fish. They're just not something that you could really fish for.
All right. A couple of questions here from Bob Todd in Frazeesburg, Ohio. First of all, is there any good shad fishing in Ohio? And have you ever used a green weenie?
I have used a green weenie. And there is no reason in the world why you couldn't use a green weenie. I really don't know. I doubt very seriously if there are any shad in Ohio.
Have to be coming out of the Great Lakes.
Right. If they did, yeah, that would be your only option there.
Yeah, okay. See, Mike Buss in Hampton, Virginia is segueing us here. Talk about presentation strategy. So let's talk about that, tactics and techniques.
Okay, sure.
For shad. What's how do you find them on the river, first of all, and then what presentation strategies do you use?
Two very good questions. Let's start first with finding the fish. They like moving water. You are not likely to find shad in what's sometimes called frog water or big dark pools as a general rule. They do like moving water, and if you go out to the Rappahannock in the height of the season, you can actually see them going upstream, so it's not hard to find them because you can see them swim right past you. And so when you fish for shad, the important thing to remember is to move. These fish move all the time. So you're not going to fish. You're not going to fish an area over and over again and constantly find fish in the same place as a general rule. Let's say for 2 days in a row you came out to this one rock and you caught fish like crazy, and the next day you didn't catch any, and you're doing the same thing. You got the same fly, it's the same time, you're using the same presentation. What's wrong? Well, it's real simple. The fish have moved upstream. They don't come and stay in one place. They move up sometimes as much as, several miles in a single day. They like to move at night primarily, and that's when they're spawning. So that's when they like to move. Now, let's say you have located a place on the river. You believe that fish are below you. You obviously can't fish upstream for them with a subsurface pattern. The easiest thing to do is to cast your fly at about a 70-degree angle. You let your fly settle down, and you want to keep a tight line. This is not something that doesn't mean that you can't let the current take your fly to begin with and pull out some extra line. But not too long into the process, you want to tighten up on that line and let it swing across almost as if you're steelhead fishing, and let the current, and my favorite way to do this is to not move the fly itself. I cast it, I let the line sink out, then I tighten the line up, and I simply let the current sweep it along. When you cast out at a 70-degree angle and you let your fly swing down to where it would be like 6 o'clock on the face of a clock, let it linger there for a minute. You don't have to start pulling it in right away. And then a little bit at a time, I would take it in a couple of inches. These are not fish that are going to hit it because it's moving fast. It's more a process of you're moving them to where they can see it. So this is not like, smallmouth, like you're trying to stimulate it to hit it. It's
right.
Not like he's going to chase it down. He's hitting it because you've got it up in his face, not because he really wants to go after it. So, again, I would use the same kind of sweeping presentation over and over again, then move either over further in the river or move up or move down, 5 or 10 feet. Now, let's say, Roger, that you have a good idea. Your buddy told you where these fish were, or maybe you fished this river before, and you have a reason to believe that there's a particular good spot. You get there early, you cast your line in, and you feel a couple of taps, but it's not going anywhere. Most of the time, as I said earlier, people have flies that are too large. So you need to...
Flies down, huh?
Skip down. Now, let's say, well, daggone it all, I broke off my last shad fly, and I really don't have anything that looks like that pattern. Well, try something else. It just has to be smaller, and it has to be something that they can see. The caller that came in earlier and said, hey, what about the green weenie? Sure, if you can see it, they can see it. So try it out there, and when you get... The first time you go shad fishing, you might be surprised at the takes. They're not really strong. Usually you get tap, 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 and then they hit it. And part of that's because more than one fisher is biting it. It's not like you're going to...
It's not the same fish, okay.
Right. It's not. A lot of times it's not the same fish. The other thing to keep in mind is this is not like trout where you find a single shad and you kind of go one-on-one with this fish. Usually they're in a school, and the difficulty is finding the school, not in getting the fish to bite. Once you find them, usually every time you sweep that fly through there, sooner or later somebody's going to pop it.
You said earlier you could see the fish going up river.
Mm-hmm.
So at times you can see the schools, I take it, and can fish to the schools, or and other times you can't, right?
Yeah, a lot of it depends on your eye level, and sometimes what I do is cheat. I know that sounds bad, and when I say cheat, what do I mean? Well, you're going to use the same tactics as the birds, the predators. In Fredericksburg, for example, I get up on top of the bridge, take a pair of polarized sunglasses, and look in the water, and you can actually see the schools. I can remember being in Fredericksburg on that Route 1 bridge and seeing a cloud go over the river. And then I realized that's not a shadow. because there wasn't a cloud in the sky. I wasn't seeing a cloud. I was seeing a huge school of shad going up to the river, so much so that it darkened out the bottom of the river, and I thought it was, you know, the shadow of a cloud. So get up on a bank if you can and look down and take your time. Don't be in a rush and sit there and look. Sometimes you'll see them breaking the surface with their dorsal fins as they're going upstream, and sometimes they're you know, swimming around in schools. If you don't have a vantage point where you can see them from the top, the other thing you can do is simply stand in the river and look for birds, particularly herons. And I tell people in my class that gray herons in Virginia generally don't have the capacity to lie. If there is a heron standing in the river and he's looking down and it's in April, he's shad fishing. Guarantee it.
Okay,
devastatingly effective.
We're going to have to finish up here. So we got a couple more questions. Chris Morris in Little Rock, Arkansas, and Kevin Brady in Coatesville, Pennsylvania, both ask, did the shad stay at a particular depth in the water column, or are they moving up and down?
Well, typically they stay as low in the water column as they can. But keep in mind, the contour of the river constantly changes. So let's say you're not getting any strikes, and you move down 3 or 4 feet, and all of a sudden you are. It could be because the contour of the river has dropped or come up. They will always be as low to the water column as they possibly can. Now you're going to say, now wait a minute, you just told me that you saw their dorsal fin. That's right, because sometimes when the water comes together in currents because of rocks or whatever, they swim up it just like a salmon, and you actually see them break the surface of the water.
Yeah.
But don't think that they're in the habit of doing that for very long. That's an anomaly. Most of the time, they're as close to the bottom as they can get.
We have Chad, question from Chad Scheel in Littleton, Colorado. He says, oftentimes I find on many of the streams and canals where I fish that shad huddle up in rapidly moving water. It appears as though they are feeding moderately aggressively, but nothing seems to catch these fish. I've tried microjigs, streamers, and even nymphs. Any suggestions?
Dynamite. No. Sometimes, you know, you'll find a pot of fish that just aren't interested in eating. Well, not eating. They happen to be satisfied with where they are, and, you know, for whatever reason, I've had this happen to me, and I'll see 40 fish in a school or 50 fish, and you keep drifting your fly through there, and they're just not, for whatever
reason. Can't aggravate them, huh?
Right. They're very docile, so you have to move on to a different school of fish, but I would try a couple of different colors before I so readily gave up.
And maybe go smaller again.
Right.
Yeah.
Because when he says, what throws me off, he says, it appears as though they're aggressively feeding. I don't exactly know what he's using to determine
yeah,
that.
They shouldn't be feeding, right. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It could be that they're not interested, they don't hit it because they're, what he sees is them actively feeding is actually them spawning.
Hmm. Okay. Or just interacting with each other
right.
or something.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, final question here. Well, a couple.
Sure.
Bill in Mississippi wants to know about dry fly action. He heard that skating a fly for shad will work. Will they come up for that?
Yeah, they will. Typically, you know, it can happen. I wouldn't recommend it as a method, but typically the shad are on their way out when they're doing that. They're not on their way in. And you can catch them sometimes by, you know, skittering a fly across the top. But, again, that's an anomaly.
And I think we already answered this, but I'll throw it out there again. Craig from Sacramento, since he's contacting us from the West Coast, he says he lives near the American River in Sacramento. They've got a good shad run. Presentations for East Coast versus West Coast, the same?
They're identical.
Okay.
They're absolutely identical.
Everything we talked about should work East Coast or West Coast. Good.
That's correct.
We're got to wrap things up here, Bo. Time went fast.
It has been a fast 90 minutes. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, well, hold on just a minute. We're not quite done. Got a few more housekeeping things. Stick around, folks, because we're going to be back and give away a few things. So,
One last thing, if I could point out, Roger. If anybody who's interested, I will be giving a class which will have a large shad section at the Virginia Fly Fishing Festival, and that's going to be held April 19th and 20th in Waynesboro, Virginia. And the website for that is www.vaflyfishingfestival.org, vaflyfishingfestival.org. So it won't be just me. There'll be a bunch of other speakers there, and it's an all-day event, and half of all the proceeds go to conservation work on the South River. So I'd invite anybody who's interested in shad fishing or fishing in Virginia in particular to come out and help promote the event.
Great, great. Well, let's take one final break, then we'll come back and we'll give away a few things. Attention fly fishers, are you aware of the proposed Pebble Mine project in southwest Alaska? This enormous open pit could generate as much as 3 billion tons of waste in a seismic area with some of the most important trout and Pacific salmon fisheries in all of Alaska, or the world for that matter. The well-being of Lake Iliamna and the entire Bristol Bay area waters may be at stake. You have not already acquaint yourself with the concerns. You can make a difference, and the ramifications reach far beyond fly fishing. Go to www.bristolbayalliance.com or Google Bristol Bay Mining. Get involved, be proactive, help protect our environment and the future of fly fishing. Just a quick reminder to everyone before you leave the website tonight, be sure, take a minute, leave us your feedback right there in Bo's section. You'll find a link that says, what did you think of the show? Click on that link, leave us your comments, we'd sure appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away a few prizes. Our drawings are randomly selected from the show's registration database, so if you didn't register for tonight's show, it's a little too late. Make sure you do it next time, because we're always giving away some great prizes, and I'm sure you'd like to be in on the drawing. So we're going to do a drawing here, first of all, for a three-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. Always a great gift to have. And their website is www.fedflyfishers.org. That's www.fedflyfishers.org if you'd like to learn more about the Federation. So let me go to our drawing here and do our random selection from the database. And our winner for that is William Plamondon in Maine. So William Plamondon in Maine. Congratulations, William, on winning that three-year membership. And the other gift we're going to give away today is Fly Fusion Magazine, a one-year subscription to that. That comes out of Calgary, Canada. Great magazine, how-to magazine. You can read more about their product and their magazine at www.flyfusionmag.com. That's flyfusionmag.com. So let's go for that one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine, and it's Travis Daly in Tennessee. Travis, congratulations on winning that subscription. And now our final is for tonight's question, and we're going to give away a $20 gift certificate, compliments of Front Range Anglers in Boulder, and their website is www.frontrangeanglers.com. And now, Bo, you're going to have to help me out on this because, you know, I learned a lot about shad tonight, too, but I don't know everything. So I've got a question. It's an easy one. I always give you guys easy questions. So the question is, and you're going to type this in on that text box on the homepage. Be sure you put your name and your location in to qualify. And the question is, which of the two shad is an endangered species in the state of Virginia? Did I ask that question okay, Bo?
Yep, that sounds fair to me.
Okay. Which of the two shad we talked about tonight is the endangered species in Virginia and one that you cannot keep if you catch? So remember, you're going to get this $20 gift certificate. You can redeem it online at frontrangeanglers.com or go into their shop if you're in Boulder, Colorado, and do that. First one is, answer is, from Bob Todd, is the hickory. Is that correct, Bo?
Yes, you can keep hickory shad.
Yeah, but we're looking for the one that's endangered.
All right, well, then
that we can't
wrong.
Keep.
Okay.
And that's wrong. Sorry there, Bob. Okay, we'll look for another answer. Oh, another hickory. Passing these up. Here we go. Bob Lewis, Oxford, Pennsylvania, American.
That would be correct.
That would be the answer.
American shad are endangered in Virginia.
There you go, Bob. You, Bob Lewis, Oxford, Pennsylvania, you just won the $20 gift certificate. Bob, what you'll need to do is, using that same text box, put in your name again and put in your email address so that I can pass those on to the folks at Front Range Anglers, and they'll get that gift certificate out to you by email. So that's it. We're done with our prizes. Thanks for helping me out, Bo, and thanks so much for being with us tonight and sharing your knowledge and your little history lessons as well. We sure enjoyed
that. Thank you very much. I enjoyed being here, and I had a great time, and look forward to seeing people come out to the Virginia Fly Fishing Festival. And if you readers or listeners have any other questions afterwards, they can certainly try me at my website, which is www.bobeasley.com, and I'll be glad to try to follow up with any questions they didn't have time for to get on there tonight.
Well, that's very generous of you. I want to thank you for that. Well, our next broadcast will be on April 2nd at 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern, and on that show we'll be interviewing Rich Palatsky, and our topic for the show will be Lake Fishing with Damsels and Dragons. Sounds like a Harry Potter deal of some sort, doesn't it?
It does.
Well, Rich is an expert on mountain lake fishing. He loves fishing with damsel and dragonflies, so you're going to learn about Rich's techniques for tying and fishing these favorite morsels that fish devour. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Platte River Fly Shop, Women's Fly Fishing Alaska, and Front Range Anglers for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-888-961-1115, extension 2, and ask for Tim Emery. He'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com. And make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so that you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.